Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ADA discussion on current treatments of paruresis, which is also known as shy bladder syndrome. My name is Sasha Sicard, and I am the Associate Director of Education and Membership Engagement here at ADAA. We are thrilled to have Dan Rocker and Ruth Lippin here with us today to discuss paruresis. Dan Rocker is a psychotherapist in private practice in New York City. He's the president of the International Paruresis Association and specializes in paruresis treatment. He is also a family and couple therapist who has completed postgraduate training at the Ackerman Institute for the Family. When not in public restrooms, Dan tends to be riding a bicycle. Welcome. Thank you for being here, Dan. We'd also like to welcome Ruth Lippin, who is a licensed clinical social worker who has had a private practice in New York City for the past 20 years, specializing in the treatment of anxiety and related disorders. She works with children, adolescents, and adults, and Ruth is a member of ADAA, where she has served on numerous committees and is currently the co-chair of the ADAA Child and Adolescent Special Interest Group. Prior to becoming a therapist, Ruth had a successful career as a public interest attorney in New York City. Ruth, Dan, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, I want to start off with kind of an introduction. So what is paruresis?
So paruresis is the inability to urinate in public restrooms or in situations where other people are. It is a social anxiety disorder, and there is generally a fear of judgment associated with it.
Yeah, Dan, did you have anything to add?
Sure, I could add to that. It's a diagnostic feature, as you point out, of social phobia. It is in the DSM-5, so if people are looking for some legitimacy, paruresis and shy bladder are in the DSM by name. And at the IPA, the International Paruresis Association, we like to conceptualize of paruresis really having kind of two components or facets, the first of which is just the actual functional inhibition of urinating, initiating a stream while under, say, time pressure, or when people can hear you, or when people can see you to be attempting to urinate. And that's the primary paruresis. The secondary paruresis, which is something that tends to accrue to people who have primary paruresis, is all the negative thoughts, feelings, self-evaluation, and shame because of having the disorder. And almost everyone who's going to present for treatment is going to come in with both secondary paruresis as well as the primary. Would you agree, Ruth?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So what are the kind of impacts that paruresis has on the lives of those affected?
It can be pretty global. When you think about anything that you would want to do in a productive life, paruresis has the capacity to interfere in a very meaningful way. For example, Freud talked about wanting to just succeed in work and in love in one's life. Imagine if every time you had to urinate, you felt that the only safe way to do so would be to use your home toilet, to use an extreme example. It would make it very difficult for you to have an occupation outside of your apartment. It might make it very difficult for you to have a meaningful relationship, not only with a significant other, but even with friendship groups. And of course, many jobs require a urine-based drug test as a part of the pre-employment package. And if it's very difficult for you to provide urine under normal circumstances, imagine when you feel that your job is on the line. And so very frequently, people with paruresis can get mischaracterized as people with drug addictions because they can't perform and illustrate that, in fact, their urine is clean.
Right. You know, paruresis is often joked about, right, in sitcoms and other areas. And as Dan was saying, the impact can be completely profound. I'm currently working with a young woman who could not go away to college. Had to live at home for college, has the opportunity to go abroad with her school, and until she started working with me, was not going to do it. So, and you know, the worst case scenario is people can become housebound. I'm working with another young woman who, you know, at this point has a 5-mile radius, and that's all she'll travel in so that she can get home.
Yeah, think about it. It's like being on house arrest.
That's right. That's right.
That sounds very stressful.
You know, and I'd just add that even within your own family, you're importing into it your own rigidity. And suddenly everyone is molding their behavior around your phobia. You know, is dad going to be able to do this? Well, no, mom definitely won't be able to attend that. And so your disorder kind of structures the family life frequently.
Yeah, as it does with many, many anxiety disorders.
Certainly.
Yes, it has an impact on, you know, family members and the quality of your life and your ability to parent.
And also, it's physically grossly uncomfortable. I mean, I actually have paruresis, which is largely managed by, you know, working on myself for the last 20 years. But I think we've all had the experience of having a very full bladder and feeling that there's no opportunity to urinate, you know, say if you're stuck on a school bus or something like that. Imagine this being an everyday feature of your life. That just, you know, some people have migraines, some people have, you know, tight shoulders when they're stressed out. But imagine if this was the default, that you just had that very uncomfortable feeling that also tends to be, of course, associated with anxiety, not just physical discomfort, and that this was happening 5 times a day.
Yeah, you know, and to add to that, what happens is you become consumed with how and when you're going to pee. Mm-hmm. So 75% of your energy and what you can think about, it can be consumed by the paruresis. And so you don't have time to focus on other important areas of your life. Yeah. Would you agree, Dan?
Oh, yeah. No, it tends to be quite in the foreground of people's minds if this is a symptom of theirs. Everything else is kind of in the background.
And there's also, we haven't talked about fluid restricting. Mm-hmm. So, right?
Oh, yes. That's one of the most common. You know, people tend to be pretty pragmatic. You know, if you realize that eating a lot of pepperoni is going to give you an upset stomach, maybe you'll shun pepperoni. It's a little more problematic if you start doing that with water. Because then, you know, you can reduce the amount of water you take in. It will reduce and darken the amount of urine that you produce. That's not good for you. It's not good for your kidneys, and you're dehydrated all the time.
Yeah. And it's unpleasant physically.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, are there different degrees of paruresis and how it might impact someone's life?
You know, I think, and Dan, tell me if you think I'm right. You know, it starts out slowly, mm-hmm. not impacting your life that much. And then if it goes untreated, it grows bigger and bigger, right? So if you feed the dog underneath the table, the dog gets fat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think often it depends on how much you use avoidance as a safety mechanism. What would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And also adding to that, there's a question of whether you really believe you have a problem if you have primary paruresis. So, as I mentioned before, the people with secondary paruresis are going to come in because they feel terrible. It's ego dystonic. They feel ashamed of themselves. If they're male, they might think they're emasculated because of the dual function of the penis. And there are plenty of people, when I tell them what I do for a living, they'll just say, oh, I'm like that. I'm just a stall guy. Or I've always been like that. You know, bathrooms are kind of gross. They just don't ascribe, or they don't rather attach any meaning to it. Mm-hmm. So they can have primary paruresis in spades, and it doesn't really trouble them all that much.
But those people have found an alternative, right? So they can pee in the stall, so it doesn't get worse. Is that correct?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So very seldom do people have primary paruresis so that's so extreme that they can't fly.
Right.
And don't develop any secondary thoughts and feelings about that.
Which makes the paruresis worse.
Right. And just in terms of thinking of it, think of it like any spectrum disorder. You know, there's some people who, you know, at intermission at the Philharmonic with a big line outside the door, they're going to be a little gun shy at the urinal. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who are functionally agoraphobic. And it's the same symptom. It's just a different level of symptomatology or symptom expression.
Interesting. So if you are experiencing paruresis, how do you start having the conversations with your loved ones, and how do you know when to go talk to a clinician, and what can how can clinicians treat it?
Well, for certain, I would say, I tend, as a part of my workshops, I'll give you guys some a little freebie. I tend to give everyone who attends one of my workshops, I'll say, look, there are three nuggets that if you think, if you can remember nothing else from this workshop, this will be worth your money. And the first is go to the bathroom when you have to, don't go to the bathroom when you don't have to. Okay, it's basically just training you to understand that urgency is your friend, not your enemy. And the second is practice your graduated exposure all the time. So I guess I'm putting the cart before the horse a little bit here, but graduated exposure is a CBT technique, and we, you know, teach individuals to create a behavioral or desensitization hierarchy and then go out and implement it in a very stepwise and gradual way. And then the third nugget is if your paruresis is going to affect other people, tell them about it. And your family is probably the first circle of individuals that it's going to affect. So let them know. You know, it's not a problem to have a problem, as long as you're willing to fess up to it and then work on your problem.
Yeah. And, you know, when do you go for treatment? When there's functional impairment. Mm-hmm. When you're limiting your life and your desires and wants because of your shy bladder.
Yeah. And if someone attended your workshop or your presentation today, what's a key takeaway that you would want our audience to know?
It is treatable, there is help, and come get treatment and so that you can have the full life that you deserve. What would you say, Dan?
I'd say those are great points. Mm-hmm. Additionally, you're not alone. This is something where a lot of the people who come to see me feel they're uniquely disabled, uniquely crazy, and it's because of the shame that attaches to it. Most people, you know, are not really happy to say I have claustrophobia, but they're not deeply ashamed to say they have claustrophobia. But to a lot of my clients, particularly my male clients, they'll come in and they'll basically be like, all right, looks like I failed toilet training. You know, and I would say, no, that's not it. Sometimes, you know, we have different responses to stress. Some people, they get an upset stomach. Some people, they get tight shoulders. Some people get migraines. Some people get insomnia. Ours goes to our pelvic floor. It's that simple.
Right. And we're just talking about a muscle.
We're just talking about
no
a muscle.
There's no reason to be ashamed.
That's very true. I want to thank you both for joining us today. I think there are a lot of people who are suffering about this who might not be aware yet. So I think an important step is increasing awareness and talking to others and maybe starting to break that shame that
yes.
impacts them.
Absolutely.
I certainly agree with you. Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us
you.
And have a great day.
You too.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks.